This is Interviews with Technical People with John Robertson
and James Haview,
a podcast where we interview technical people in STEM fields
to discuss the past, present, and future from their perspective.
Today, we're joined by Zach Eichholz. Zach is the Sustainability Program Manager and Resilience Planner for the City of Cape Canaveral, Florida. In his position, he helps research and develop new ways to help the city become more efficient, safer, less carbon intensive, and more resilient to future challenges and natural hazards, all while trying to save costs for taxpayers. He is also a climate and eco-fiction writer and has self-published 3 books since 2017. Zach, welcome to the show.
Thanks, guys. Good to be here. This is great.
Yeah. So just a little context. We were particularly excited to have you, not only because I've known you for a really long time and you're a good friend, but our first 3 guests, if you take a look at what we had there, they were all relatively aerospace related in one way or another, right? We had Suresh, who did ground support equipment for airplanes, Marie, who did like true like space things, and then Jeremy, who was a pilot. So Zach, you have the distinct honor of being the first person on who has nothing to do with flying things or space travel or anything like that. So that is a distinct honor.
Cool.
Could be a good change of pace.
Awesome.
I hope so. Why don't we start with this, Zach? Why don't you tell us in your own words, what is it that you do?
Cool. So I'm the Sustainability Program Manager and Resilience Planner for the City of Cape Canaveral. And I've been there for just over a year now. They hired me right out of college, thankfully. And basically what I do for them is I take all the challenges that they have, issues, and past, present, and future, and I try and come up with ideas and solutions that can steer the city in a safer direction, that can make them more resilient and be able to, you know, build back better should something, God forbid, ever happen. And, you know, even just to deal with the present day issues of the city's growing larger. The city has an aging population. What do you do with those residents? How do you keep them going safe and secure? And I also like to think that my job is you know, not so much always coming up with the things that can be the solutions to these problems, but educating the staff, who is generally, you know, a little bit older and a little bit, you know, they've done things a certain way for a very long time. Government doesn't change that quickly. And when it does change, it can take a while to see things occur. And the world changes so fast nowadays, and technology updates, and there seems to be a new scientific study done all the time about things like climate change and the sea level rise. Oh, now it's going to be this high. Oh, this hurricane is going to do this now. So, you know, being able to steer these people and show them, you know, this is maybe not the best way we're doing it right now. Why don't we try it this way? Oh, and we might save a little money too while we're doing it. That's my job, really, to point the direction that the city can go that makes the most sense for taxpayers, and to really ensure the longevity of the city while also meeting the needs of the present population. So that's kind of it in a nutshell. Sustainability and resilience are huge topics, and we could probably talk about 4 hours and not come close to covering everything, but that's it basically in a nutshell.
That is so broad and so awesome.
Very interdisciplinary.
Yeah, and I'll be honest, like I often picture you as just being the guy who's like literally paid to go in there and excitedly educate and advocate for these things.
Not far off.
Right. And that's also just like who you are. You're so naturally enthusiastic. Can we get into some of the details for like what some of that's looked like so far? Like maybe just some examples, right? Like when you show up for a day of work, you know, what are the things that you're typically like trying to chip away at?
Sure. I think one of the best examples I could come up with I'm really big into vehicle electrification, and trying to get our fleet to be, you know, more sustainable. For me, it's really all about lowering carbon emissions, because this is, you know, this is a top priority to deal with things like climate change, to at least, you know, we're set into to have a warming for sure, probably over 2 degrees Celsius by the end of this, probably by mid-century, actually. But
so that like goal of yours, right? You just said lower emissions. Is that like part of your job description, or is that just something that you recognize needs to happen?
It's something I recognize that needs to happen. It's not explicitly stated in my job description,
right?
Probably for reasons to unfortunately that subject can be taken in a little bit of a political capacity when it shouldn't be, and to get my position solidified and passed in the budget, and the council members all see this, they play it safe and you say managing our finances through sustainable actions, like we don't have to pay for gas anymore, that's great, but while we do that, we also don't pollute as much. So vehicle electrification, I want to do that for lowering our carbon emissions, but also for the resilience factor, because we have the ability, or at least those types of vehicles give us the ability to do on-site charging with renewable energy installations on, for us, it's all about really solar. That's the thing that makes most sense. Our public works director is a really nice guy. He's been doing this type of stuff for decades, former army man, really great guy, but he's been doing it for decades. So he has a fleet of F-150s, F-250s, even larger trucks, some SUVs. And, I come in here, at the time, this 26-year-old kid for all intents and purposes. And it's like, I think we should use electric vehicles. Won't the battery die the second it starts pulling something? You know what, Jim? Let me write you something. I'll be back. So 2 weeks later, I come back and I deliver him a report that's about 50 pages long, outlining a vehicle transition plan to electrics and hybrids and plug-in hybrids. And it lays out, because there's a lot of alternative fuel vehicles you can choose from, but some don't make sense for our little city. We're a barrier island. So, I can't trench a natural gas pipeline to get natural gas powered vehicles like waste management does, compressed natural gas. Great for them, not good for us. I don't want to sink a gas line out there. It's very expensive and it relies on the mainland. So I was, Jim, this is the way an electric car works. This is their maintenance. This is their fueling needs, so to speak. This is how we can make them on site and totally resilient should a hurricane ever come, which we know they do. And this is how much money I can save you. This is great. He reads it, to his credit, he read it in a day, which I was shocked and thankful for. And the next day he comes up to me, he says, Zach, I understand it now. I understand why you want to do this. And I'm for this. So long as you can get me a vehicle that matches the replacement vehicle's capabilities that exist, already, I am for any vehicle that you think we should shift to. And I was like, whoa, that actually worked. Oh my God, science worked. This is great. So that's probably like one of my biggest examples I always pull from when can I actually affect change in the city? And yes. So to that end, Jim is adding a Nissan Leaf to the fleet next year to replace an F-150. And for anybody that's listening, a Nissan Leaf is a small, a hatchback, that has about 150 miles of range in the version we're going to get. And it could probably fit in the bed of an F-150.
But my boss bought a Nissan Leaf about a year ago.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, it's 150 miles and in the cold in Maine, you get about 100 miles in the winter, and it's a four-door hatchback and it works for tooling around the city, but I'm curious how it replaces a 150.
So I'm glad you asked that. So the, part of my, job, like I said, is kind of identifying these inefficiencies sometimes. And the F-150 that it's replacing was being used for janitorial duties. The bed was not being used at all. It was literally to ferry somebody and their cleaning supplies to and from facilities in a city that, mind you, is only 1.9 square miles.
That's so great for a hatchback.
Yeah, exactly. So the seats go down even, it's get even more room. So I said, Jim, we don't need to do this. Why don't you move the F-150, replace one of our F-250s with it from that's like 06. This is a 2016 F-150. And, get some more efficiency there. It's a good truck still. We can keep it for a while longer. And then we'll have this Nissan Leaf over here just cruising silently around the city going buzz, buzz. And, it's it's going to be great. And we're not going to release any emissions. We're going to save a lot of money compared to the F-150. And he was like, boom, let's do it. It's in the budget. The budget gets passed on Thursday and we'll have another electric in the fleet. So that'll be two electrics. And we're adding another hybrid for our code enforcement, a Toyota RAV4 to replace an old Chevy pickup. And we're going to have 20% of our fleet electrified in some way by next year. But we have a 30 vehicle fleet. So 20% of that will be electrified in some way. We'll have two all electrics and then the rest will be hybrids. So it'll be great.
That is so amazing. I want to take a moment and pause because I think probably the three of us all know about the city of Cape Canaveral, but can you just give us a little context for like the size, where the city is? I feel like I need to go out there and say it. The city of Cape Canaveral is different from like the place where we launched the rockets from, right? Like,
yes.
This is where the people live that's near the Kennedy Space Center.
Yes. I'm really glad you brought this up because a lot of people do get it confused about what it is. Because there's like three different things called Cape Canaveral out here in Brevard County, where we are. So the city of Cape Canaveral, 1.9 square miles, has about 10,300 residents, was incorporated in 1963. It is directly south of Port Canaveral, which is a very up and coming port. It's the second largest cruise port by passenger volume in the world, which really helps out the East Florida or East Central Florida tourism industry. Connects things like Disney, the Orlando Airport.
What number one is?
I don't know what number one is. I've always been curious.
I'll put it in the show notes. I'm just curious.
I've been through Port Canaveral on a cruise ship. So,
oh, there you go.
I'm part of that.
Yeah, I used to drive by there all the time to go surfing in Cocoa Beach, cool town. Oh, nice. But I don't know that I've been to the city of Cape Canaveral. Or do you have to drive through there to get to like Cocoa?
If you're driving south on US or not US one, State Road A1A, yes, yeah. you would have to drive through it.
Oh, okay, so I've probably been there.
Yeah, but yeah, that Port Canaveral is. You know, at any given time, they had, well, when the pandemic wasn't happening, there were too many ships to fit in the port. They would have to, stagger the schedule so they'd come in at different times because they're adding another terminal. They just finished it. And, unfortunately, no one can really use it right now. But this terminal will be home to the Mardi Gras. And this is the port's first liquefied natural gas powered cruise ship, which is pretty cool. That's really good at lowering tailpipe emissions. But
by the way, a future topic that I really want to cover is sustainability in cruise ships. Because that is a really interesting topic. I don't think we have time to cover it today with everything on the schedule, but like we might have to do a follow-up, or if you know anybody who's like knows all about that, like spoiler alert, like cruise ships are really polluting, and yeah, that'll yeah. know about it.
They're very dirty.
But anyway, we'll save that for another time.
Yeah. So yeah, we've got the port directly above us. We're so close. We used to share some utilities. We don't anymore, but we used to. And then directly above that is the Cape Canaveral Air Force Station. And then above that is the Kennedy Space Center. Both entities launch rockets. They just launched one like no more than almost exactly an hour ago. I think they launched a Falcon 9 rocket. And they actually landed the booster back, that's always fun. But we're a barrier island. There is only one road in and out, and that is State Road A1A. Goes north to south through the city, carries about 35,000 cars a day, and I would wager that that's probably going to go up as we get out of this pandemic and tourism starts to return. We'll have over 2,000 hotel rooms in the city, so by next year we have 9 hotels starting or completed or under construction at this time. So it's a very tourism dependent city. And it has an older population. About 35% of the city is over the age of 65. So we have an aging population, but that's quickly being offset by people coming in to work for the new, private organizations like SpaceX, Blue Origin, that are moving in all the time to the Cape and expanding their facilities. So it's a really cool confluence of modern aerospace, and SpaceX has set up shop in the city at a facility. A few other aerospace companies have, but I don't know who they are offhand. So yeah, it's this really cool confluence of, you know, modern technology coming in with a small town vibe, beach town. The Indian River Lagoon is to our east, or excuse me, to our west, which is extremely environmentally sensitive habitat that has a lot of systemic issues, unfortunately, with algae blooms and fish kills that we have to deal with. But it's just like a really great area to be right now. A lot of stuff's happening, and fortunately, the city's put sustainability and resilience at its forefront for me to come in and do my job. So that's kind of the city in a little snapshot.
I have a couple questions about the job. Was it a new position that you stepped into? Was it already existing? And the other is, how open is the city to the work you're doing? Are you kind of, you know, a one-man crusade, or is, you know, the government and the employees open to what you do? And also, like, how big of a team are you working with? Do you have people around you, or is it a one-man show?
Good questions. It was a new position that I filled. It didn't exist before. I'm a solid team of two. The city planner, fortunately, works hand in hand with me.
Nice.
She's really great. On the younger side of the workforce, like myself, we are probably, at least in our building, which is City Hall, probably two of the youngest employees on staff. We have a total staff of about 70, if you include some part-time people, probably 60 full-time. And my department is called Community and Economic Development. I've bounced around departments three times. This is my third department. I had to change offices every time.
So they're still trying to figure out where you belong.
Yes. And that I did want to bring that up. And I've seen this issue with other cities where when they hire somebody like me, at first they sometimes don't know exactly where to put them. And that kind of falls back into the interdisciplinary nature of the position, where, you know, I have hats in every single department in the city, whether it's leisure services with event planning, trying to, you know, use less plastics, to all the way to, you know, public works with these large scale infrastructure projects, fleet electrification, things like that. So I go everywhere, but I'm in one department. A lot of bigger cities usually have their own dedicated sustainability department. And the city has had interest in that in a few years. You know, once the position grows a little bit, get some bigger projects under our belt. And in terms of support from other employees, it's generally very good. But it generally takes convincing to show them what we need to do and why we need to do it. And finances usually come first. Usually I have been noticing that those aren't sometimes the case anymore, which is good. All of a sudden we're all talking about flooding in Cape Canaveral because we had a thunderstorm a few weeks ago that, it was a 1 in 25 year rain event that we got that flooded large sections of the city. And it only lasted for maybe about 20 minutes, but it delivered, you know, at one point I think we were up to, you know, this is probably only for a minute or two, but we were getting like 22 inches of rain an hour.
Whoa, wow.
So, you know, and council members, and rightly so, they got upset. They're like, why is our streets flooding? And it's not only because, you know, of more rain with global warming and things like that, more a wetter atmosphere, but the city is mostly built out. There's not much space for water to go naturally into the ground. It's one giant paved area now. The city's stormwater infrastructure is old, doesn't have much capacity, takes a while for things to drain. It normally takes stormwater infrastructure a while to drain. So when you throw this extra stuff on it, the sea level is higher, the lagoon is higher where the outfalls are. That kind of makes like a saltwater plug sometimes. So, you know, they come up with the point of, well, this needs to be fixed. And I don't really care how much money it takes. Like, what are we going to do to solve this? Because this is affecting, you know, our voters, our taxpayers' lives quite a lot. And it seems to be happening more and more. Sometimes they don't make the connections as to why. And that's what staff's job is to educate them. But, you know, I'm seeing at least more and more of the instances of, what does Zach think about that? Can we do this? Can we do that? And I've definitely noticed the change of when I first came on. It was like, oh, that's, you know, this is good. I like this job. This is, I think Zach's doing a good job. He's got some cool ideas, but you know, let's just think this through maybe a little bit more. Now it's like, okay, Zach, what are we doing? How do we do this? Can we do this? Can we do that? And it's a nice change. It's cool. And I do think that comes naturally with the position. The city has also, through my position, gotten a lot of recognition for things. And a lot of the staff and the council members are seeing that when cities do sustainable initiatives and things of that nature, it kind of showcases the city as this progressive, forward-thinking place that has its residents' needs in the at the forefront, where it thinks that, you know, I want to make this city green and healthy, and I want to be able to have people live here for a very long time comfortably. And when people see that, who are, you know, prospective to the area, maybe they just got a job with SpaceX or something or Blue Origin, and they say, oh, Cape Canaveral is doing a lot of cool stuff. They have this, and this, and that really shows me that they're looking out for my interests and my needs and possibly my kids' needs, my children's needs, who may have their own lives here one day. So I think I want to move there. I think I want to invest time there. I want to go shop there. You know, oh, charging stations. I want to go drive there. I can shop there all day, go to the beach, spend some money. So they see this.
The city will attract a younger demographic with a lot of these benchmarks.
Exactly. They see the benefits. They see the recognition. They, you know, we got an award from the U.S. Green Building Council, and the USGBC is one of the, you know, premier green building societies in the country. They're the ones that do, they started the LEED certification program. So very, very prestigious. And we got an award from them that I put in for a municipal complex, it's called, where basically put a bunch of municipal buildings in close proximity to make this walkable, bikeable inner city area that replaces a downtown area. Because we don't really have a downtown. But this is kind of the next best thing, where you have a library, you have a police station, you have a dog park, tennis courts, leisure services facilities, city hall. It's all right there within a visual distance of each other, within, you know, one block, two block, three block. And we got an award for that. And it was a big deal for this tiny little city that's never really had this type of stuff before. So the attention and the support is only growing. And I'm thankful for that. So team of two, support's growing, and it was a new position.
Nice.
All right. I have another question, and it's also kind of a two-part question. So here you are, right, the small coastal city, and you're directed to institute sustainability and resiliency changes, right? Mm-hmm. So do you have like what is your long-term roadmap, not just in terms of like goals, because I know a lot of cities will have goals, like you mentioned, like the 20% fleet electrification and so forth, or like carbon reduction, but like what is your roadmap? Are there overarching goals? And then the bigger question I have is like, what is your way of getting there? There's a lot of new technology out there now, and some that's even old. And I know it can be a little difficult to keep track of all of it, like what's good in certain regions, what's good in the case of the city of Cape Canaveral, or like what are you able to implement within the scope of your job, right? So anyway.
Yeah, good questions. The roadmap. Roadmaps help. I guess I have two answers for that. One, the city has an existing vision statement that was put forth or that was adopted by the council, that was developed in cooperation with resident input. I think they've had it for almost a decade, probably a little bit more. It's literally plastered on the hall, on the wall of City Hall, for everybody to read in the lobby. It's a few paragraphs. It's very nice. Basically says, you know, we want to be a bikeable, walkable, well-lit community that attracts this, that does this, has environmental stewardship, all that good stuff. So that's really helpful, because in the vision statement is the word sustainable. So it's always a nice fallback to say, hey guys, you have that on the wall, that word. The second thing that is really truly a roadmap, not just a vision, is our up-and-coming resilience action plan, which I have been writing for the better part of a year now. One of the first things I started with the city was this document to become the fallback for everybody to know what to do, where we need to go, that sets actual tangible targets. And this plan will hopefully, it was supposed to have been adopted earlier in the year, but COVID-19 came and kind of jumbled things up, unfortunately, canceled a lot of events that we were supposed to speak at about it and things like that. But this document is 120 pages, and it has 8 action categories. And within these action categories are things that we call preparedness targets. And there's 56 of them. And they go into things like natural resources, green economy, transportation, energy, quality of life and social outreach, sea level rise and storm readiness, and built environment. And they set the vision and the direction out 30 years in 5, 15, and 30-year intervals to strive for. The reason we did 30 years is because the year, in 2019, we did a vulnerability assessment with a grant from NOAA. And we worked with an entity called the East Central Florida Regional Planning Council. Took me 6 months to remember that name. And this organization did a vulnerability assessment that highlighted where we are most vulnerable in regards to sea level rise, hurricane storm surge, the two of them put together, coastal flooding, and what was the last one? I think it was something like sunny day flooding, or you know, flooding that doesn't involve rain. You know, as the title suggests, it found some pretty good vulnerabilities, and it made recommendations for what we should do, but no targets. You know, that's our job. That's my job.
Is your city any more vulnerable than the ones around it? Are you guys in better shape?
I'd say we're just as vulnerable. I don't think we're in any better shape, but we're just as vulnerable as cities like Cocoa Beach directly to our south, Satellite Beach, Patrick Air Force Base, because we have we are pretty low geographically speaking on the lagoon side, which is, you know, people think that flooding will come from the ocean, and it, you know, will eventually, but for us it'll actually start on the west side of the city, on the lagoon side, where, you know, right now we have some condominiums and apartment complexes that are, you know, at a high tide probably no more than 3 feet, 2 feet maybe, where the waves will lap over on a normal windy day. So, we have communities telling us that they're swales where stormwater will flow into. They don't drain as quickly anymore. The standing water stays around for a while. I've had that, people tell me that. So we're pretty vulnerable to sea level rise. And we will probably start, according to the assessment, we'll probably start seeing permanent areas of inundation as soon as the 2040s, in some of our lowest areas. We have some wetlands that remain in the city that we're trying to make them be parks, so they'll never be developed, and they'll be designed to flood with boardwalks and things like that. But yeah, I mean, it's not looking good.
So what I'm thinking of now, and it's funny because all the times we've talked, I feel like we haven't really touched on this topic, but I'm picturing those maps that people show that try to illustrate the potential effects of climate change, right?
Yeah, we got those.
Right. And very often the state that's like obviously just totally inundated with water is Florida. Like if you were to just take a look at the map, you're like, whoa, Florida's in trouble. You know, most of the other ones are okay. And so you guys are kind of on the front lines of that, right? I mean, you would experience the effects very quickly.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a big responsibility.
Yeah. So the thing I should tell you, that the end-all conclusion of this vulnerability assessment is that the city is looking at anywhere from 5 to 8 feet of sea level rise by 2100.
And what's your highest point?
It's lower than 8 feet. I think it's probably about 6 feet.
Okay.
I'm just curious if you happen to know, sea level's currently rising, right? Like I believe we can measure it. Is that just like taking a look at the sea level rise and assuming a linear continuation of that, or are there more sophisticated models that predict like an accelerating sea level rise?
How
sure are we of that number?
The confidence, because like to me, a 3 foot range is pretty, like that's a lot to work with. That's right. To me, that's 5 to 8 feet is the difference between a city that could still perhaps be livable to a city that it would have to be abandoned for sure. You know, even the 5 feet is really probably stretching it without some major infrastructure modifications. Because at that point, any type of hurricane, even a tropical storm, would probably put the remainder of the above ground below water. The models, they always have a huge number of variables that go into them. And they took their data from the Army Corps of Engineers, who does sea level rise modeling, and NOAA, of course. NOAA's, you know, done this stuff for a very long time.
Yeah, those are two legit organizations.
Right. So the Army Corps of Engineer one was the lower end model. And the NOAA was the higher end, the 8 foot one. I don't know exactly how they came to those conclusions, and like the exact details of how the models are put in. I do know they're probably, like many forecast models, are very complicated, and there's many variables that go into them, because you know it's a little hard to predict in the sense that, like, for any given ice shelf that you're looking at, terrestrial ice shelf, that's an important distinction, because meltwater from already frozen water is not doing anything. It's the input of ice from terrestrial glaciers and ice packs that you see on, you know, Antarctica and across the Canadian tundra, Alaska.
That's really interesting. So like the polar ice caps, because they're over water, when they melt, in principle, they don't add to sea level rise, right?
Even when they're solid, they're already floating, so they're already affecting the ocean levels.
I never considered that. That's interesting.
Okay. Same with the Antarctic ice shelves,
right? But it's certainly an indication of what's happening, but it's not necessarily contributing
to
exact water,
right? And those melting, that already frozen water has its own problems, because then you start increasing or decreasing the albedo,
right?
You know, what was white will now become basically black from the and absorb more sunlight and more heat. But, you know, the point I'm trying to get at here is, you know, it's impossible to know, you know, say I'm probably mispronouncing it, but I think it's called the Thwartz Glacier or something to that effect, in Antarctica. You know, if this one glacier goes, we're looking at like inches of sea level rise, probably within a decade or two of it going. So, but there's no way to really know when that exactly happens. So there's a lot of factors in here that, you know, I try and say, like, guys, look, it says this, but chances are it's probably going to be higher, or things like that. Or maybe it holds, hopefully. I don't know. But, you know, there's so many variables, which is why we stress the preparedness thing. Like, we got to get on this right now, because you really don't know when this could go all out, where that tipping point is reached and there's really no return. You know, while we still have time, we should probably be getting ready for this. So it's hard to predict exactly what is going to happen, which is it's a thing that skeptics usually point out. It's like, oh, you don't really know. You can't tell me exactly this, that, and this. And it's like, well, I can't really tell you where Hurricane Laura was going to go. It was going to go to Florida at one point, but it ended up going to Louisiana. And within like 4 days of it doing that, they did know it was going to Louisiana. So there is confidence. It's just you gotta kind of trust the science at one point, and at least say where we're at right now is that something is going to happen, and we need to prepare for that something, because that's in the best interest of all of our tax base for their future.
So, but let's just say it is that 8 feet of rise. I mean, what do you do? How do you prepare for that?
Honestly, I don't think you can. For a city of our size, you're probably looking at a managed retreat at that point, where I don't, it's a really good question, because you don't have many case studies that I'm aware of a city moving itself because of sea level rise yet. There are cities, a good example is, It's not in North America. It's in Asia. It might come to me later, but
is it like not the Maldives?
Oh, it might be Jakarta.
Jakarta, okay.
I think it might be Jakarta, but one of those cities in Southeast Asia is moving. They're building a new capital because this current city is the capital. Because the city, it's two things. It's sinking geographically, like Venice, but then you have sea rise on top of that. So it's a 1-2 punch. But they're moving in a managed retreat where they'll be moving their capital and their infrastructure to a city more inland to deal with this. But for a city our size, honestly, at that point, the stuff that we're trying to do right now is kind of a stepping stone to say, if we can do as much as we can right now and for the next 30 years, we can perhaps weather this storm. And hopefully by that time, mankind will progress to a point where its technology can overcome maybe this, where we're doing massive carbon sequestration from the atmosphere, putting it underground somewhere or turning it into a carbon neutral fuel. Or, we get into the realm of like geoengineering, which is a whole nother topic that's controversial still. As you know, is that a good idea? Do we put sulfate particles in the atmosphere to scatter sunlight and block it out? Does that ruin the ozone hole? So, hopefully we get the city to a point where, it's 2060 and things have gone, about 4 feet, 3-4 feet of sea level rise, but we're weathering the storm. We've got seawalls in place. We've got marshes that can flood. We've risen roads. We've got infrastructure, that can be raised up, homes that have collapsible first floors. And we mankind pulls together and is able to do something about it. And we start seeing the emissions go down. Eventually we see heat go down into the next century, and Cape Canaveral's weathered the storm long after I'm gone. But
and that's a really good point, because 100 years is a long time from now.
Oh yeah.
Just seeing how fast technology is growing. Like we could have totally different issues by then. Like we could have totally solved the climate crisis and beyond, like, I don't know, whatever else, aliens or something, who knows?
Right.
Wow. Well, okay. So on that topic, I know another thing that you're really passionate about and probably involved is, like, one thing that we all can do in our own way is just reduce greenhouse gas emissions, right? Locally. And probably in your case, like at a city level, which is a really unique perspective that you have.
Right.
So like, what is your city doing, and like, what can cities do?
Sure. For us, it's first transitioning our facilities off of the grid where we can. We always say we're appropriate and feasible. That's the way you say it. Cause it's not always appropriate and it's not always feasible, but one day I think it will be. And we have two buildings right now that are set to become the first city facilities completely powered and partially powered by solar energy. And this should happen next year. Whoa. Again, the pandemic kind of delayed things, but we have a new community center going up in the heart of the city called the Multi-Generational Facility. It's kind of a cool name, but this will basically be a facility that is for all ages, has an indoor gym, track, basketball court, education facilities, multi-purpose rooms, splash pad outside, an open field for different recreational activities. And this will have a 50 kilowatt solar array on the roof, ballasted, only 5 penetration points. This will probably offset about half the building's usage. And then we have the CAPE Center, it's called. And that's an acronym that I can't remember offhand, but it's basically a cultural heritage center that will celebrate the unique history of the city being so close to the space program, and have education spaces, art classes, a kiln for doing pottery, like really cool stuff. And this is actually a redevelopment of the city's old city hall that was built in 1963 that the staff used until 2017 when we got a new city hall that replaced it. And imagine 30 people crammed in a building that's John and James, it probably had a footprint less than the size of Robert's Hall, and only one story. Small.
That's pretty tight. You're on top of each other.
Yeah. So, but that building will have its footprint increased by about 30%, and it will get a 33 kilowatt ballasted system on the roof that will completely be able to offset the building's usage during peak hours. And I think we'll get the building pretty, its energy utility costs pretty low. So right off the bat, both of those, we know how much emissions we'll be saving. I should have looked this up to tell you guys, but it was a lot. It was, you know, metric tons worth per year between the two facilities. It's amazing to me how, you know, because a 50 kilowatt array and a 33 kilowatt array, those aren't the biggest system. You know, they're certainly bigger than home systems, but they're not in the grand scheme of things when you see these like multi megawatt installations, utility scale being built out in the deserts or out here in Florida. You know, they're not that much, but it makes a difference. It starts to add up real quickly how much you can start to save. On our water reclamation facility, this is really cool. We're putting in for a grant that will hopefully allow us to get thin film flexible solar panels to cover the domes of our reclamation water storage tanks. We have three of them.
Interesting.
Because we have no space out there for a traditional system, ground or roof. And this is the next best thing. And I think thin film for a while there was probably not the most cost effective or efficient style of solar panel for what we want to do. But now it's reached a point. There's some examples you can see in the Northeast where this particular company we're working with has put these types of panels over oil storage tanks, ironically. So we think between the three domes that we have, we're going to get a 400 kilowatt system out of that. And we're going to hook it up to a microgrid and battery storage system to help offset the facility's existing diesel generator and offset, you know, at peak hours to put in, switch on the batteries to get some load off. Really cool stuff. And that system too will be able to save metric tons worth of emissions every single year. Really cool stuff.
Why in that case does it need to be thin film? Is it to save mass or is it going to be like flexible?
Good question. Both. Yeah, we can't. When you're talking about reclaimed water like that, there's a lot of government regulation that, you know, you basically can't even touch it. You know, we'd have to go through so many permitting hoops to be able to put a traditional solar panel on there that would require a penetration point probably. And we can't penetrate those domes at all. We can't touch that water inside. So this allows it to be on top of the domes and get arguably almost every single square foot on that dome producing power, where you probably have a lot of gaps in a traditional system because you're kind of constrained by the, you know, the rectangular shape of each panel. And for weight, you know, that'd be a very heavy system. The largest tank we're talking about is 2.5 million gallons. And it's huge. I don't think it'd be able to hold the weight of a traditional system. So with this, it goes on via an adhesive that can withstand winds up to 160 miles an hour, which is perfect because one day
for Florida.
Yeah, we could get that. You know, between systems like this, we just converted all of our water reclamation facilities, street lighting to solar, 54 units, saving over 5,000 kilowatt hours a month for us. We've got three main roads on solar street lights now, and we're about to upgrade them because they're first gen units. And that's pretty cool. I'm excited to do that. So it just adds up. Even though we're small, we can definitely play our part. And I do want to stress that to everybody that little things make a difference. There was this quote that I love. I'm probably butchering the quote, but it's paraphrasing. It's basically like, you know, nobody has to do this. Everybody doesn't have to do this perfectly. But if everybody did this imperfectly, it'd be a heck of a lot better than where we're at now. If everybody just tried, we would be in a lot better place. And we could probably all make a difference, even by just trying.
So on that note, so it sounds like everything so far has been kind of like at the municipal level. Do you have any ability to influence the sustainability of non-city buildings and properties and so forth? Or is that really just up to like the house owner? Like, in other words, like is there any way you're able to influence like rooftop solar just in your communities?
Yes, I think so. Two ways. One, just through basic education and outreach. And the other is through actual code changes or requirements set forth by the council. You know, because we could pass something. I draw on a lot of examples from large municipalities, and I don't know how applicable they could be to us because we're dealing with a different population set. But the city of Atlanta, they've mandated that I think every new parking lot, private or public, needs to have 25% EV capacity, you know, where they could be able to, which is cool. That's awesome. So yes, we could mandate that. We are looking at code changes that will allow for people to raise their homes off the ground to deal with flooding more so that floodwaters can pass underneath their living space. Code changes that would call for more permeable, pavement where stormwater could go through it and go into the soil to be naturally filtered instead of running off into the lagoon untreated with.
I said that, you know, that stuff's fairly expensive, but it's pretty cool.
Yes, it is.
I work for a Department of Transportation, and they taught me that the three most important things of building a road are drainage, drainage, and drainage, which seems to be an issue where you are.
Yes, and you bring up a good point because it is expensive. Most of those solutions are expensive. So can you, in a city that of the barrier island cities we have in Brevard County, we're probably the poorest, actually. Our average income is like $42,000, which is not all that much. We have, I think, over 20% of our population is considered at or below the poverty line. So can you burden a person with this type of requirements when they're trying to build a house or trying to build a new business? You know, it's tough to balance that and to see what's possible. We absolutely could, to answer your question. Based on how long I've been working there, our main approach seems to be educational outreach and just leading by example, where if we get those facilities with the solar panels and we publicly display the data, which we intend to do, both online and with real-time monitors in the lobbies, you know, we can say, look, guys, we just saved all this money by doing this, and you could do this too.
And that's actually what I was thinking. Like you noted that, like, for example, some of your efforts are being recognized by organizations
right.
for what you're doing. And then that therefore is going to attract people, not only young people, but people who want to participate in that. And then slowly you can get a change in the culture, or not even necessarily a change, just an evolution of the culture of the city.
Right.
To where it's just what happens there.
Right.
To me, that seems like a very organic way of doing it. Cause I agree. There's difficulty in forcing people to do things that they don't want to do, right?
That can be pretty unpopular.
Yeah.
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 And you don't want to be that person who's just like making people's lives difficult, right? By like burdening them with these requirements.
Right. You want the buy-in. You want the natural buy-in. That's usually the best way to a person's heart. A great example of that, real quickly, is the city has an annual sea oat planting event. The sea oat is a native plant. It basically just looks like tall grass that we do every year. And it's native to the state of Florida. I should say actually the Southeast. Very common. You've probably seen it and not even realized it sticking out of the dunes of a beach. And the city for the last 15 years, although I've been told it's been longer than that, but at least for record keeping purposes, the last 15 years, the city has planted over 100,000 sea oats on its beach. And last year we did 10,000. Year before that, we did 10,000. Year before that, we did 7,000. And it's only gotten more and more. I think 10,000 is actually the most we can buy. We're allowed to buy. But this program attracts dozens of people from all over the city every single year to plant these tiny little plants. And, you know, to spend 4 hours in the hot sun on the hot beach in the hot sand, planting these things. And you get this little goop. It looks like that goop, we call it, it's like a water gel, and you stick it in the hole and it waters the plants while they become established.
Oh.
It's really cool. Yeah. They got to throw that in. It's a really dirty thing, but yet every single year, time and time again, all these city residents show up and they look forward to it and they can't wait. Why? Because they have learned that planting these sea oats in the dunes increases their condo, their home's survival chances when a major storm happens. Because these things shore up the dunes so strongly that they don't break. the dunes won't collapse and they will naturally build themselves up because the plant's root system act like a rebar would in a concrete building. And they also act as a windbreak that catch sand so that they literally raise the height of the dunes naturally. And their roots that go down, you know, 6-7 feet hold this stuff in place. And they're like, this is great. We're protecting our, you know, our beach here. We're making it look better. We're providing habitat for animals. And my home won't be destroyed probably in the next, or at least I'm increasing the chances of it not being destroyed in the next hurricane. And, you know, this buy-in is unbelievable. This, there's no question as to why we do this. There's no question to why we spend thousands of dollars on these plants every year, because they see the returns and the beach is held time and time again through, you know, we've had, oh God, we've had three, four storm systems pass us in the last 4 years, Hurricane Matthew, Hurricane Irma, Hurricane Dorian, and Hurricane Isaias, just this year. And it'll probably be another one the way it's looking, but, it's incredible what education and buy-in can do. And I think it can be applied to some of this newer stuff that we're starting to talk about with renewable energy and batteries and all that good stuff.
I feel like this is a great segue for something else also, because I know you've also done your part in trying to raise awareness for these types of issues. You've actually self-published several books.
Yeah.
And I've read one. I don't think I've read the other ones, although I read some of the short stories. and they're fantastic reads. Can you just go into a little bit about what you do there, what you were doing, and how you were able to use that as another medium to reach a whole different set of people?
Sure. You know, I was just really, for a long time going into college when I changed majors to sustainability, from meteorology, I love the weather. Weather has always fascinated me. And I actually still get a lot of that world in sustainability, which is
especially,
nice.
Especially when you're studying so much climate change stuff.
Exactly. Exactly. You know, I was just looking around and I just felt like this sustainability stuff, climate change, it just wasn't connecting for a lot of people. Like people had a real hard time. And I totally understand it. You know, the time scales we talk about with this stuff is insane. People don't care about what's going to happen in 50 years. They're worried, especially nowadays, they're worried about what's going to happen tomorrow. You know, I can't even remember when I brush my teeth. How am I going to remember to help these polar bears that I'm never going to see or really care about? So like, you know, bringing these issues down to the level where people can understand them, they can digest them easily, not from a textbook or from somebody that's an alarmist or screaming at them that they need to do this or else we're all going to die.
Cause you're definitely not that. Like you never like freaked me out with what you were saying.
Right.
That was never your strategy, but you were always very like realistic about it.
Right. And yeah, it's just, and scientists, I'm not trying to say that all scientists are like this, but they generally have a little bit harder of a time getting to people's level and explaining things thoroughly to where they can understand it and at least put it in perspective for them to understand.
I think that there's some truth there.
Yeah. So I just thought, you know, there's got to be another way to talk to people about this and really engage them so that they can, you know, not only understand it's real, but understand that this is something that they can get excited about even and see it as opportunities. So I got into the area of climate fiction, which is there's a little bit of debate about whether it's its own genre or if it's a subset of science fiction.
I love the phrase cli-fi.
Cli-fi, yes.
Climate fiction, cli-fi.
Cli-fi. A great, real quick for the listeners, a great example that everybody can probably think of is The Day After Tomorrow, the movie from 2004, right. Roland Emmerich. That's straight up cli-fi. That's the climate change is front and center in that film. And even though it's portrayed very poorly with Hollywood science, there's a root issue in it that is really good to remember and really made an impact. Like a lot of people like that film that I've talked to and they say, oh yeah, that's a fun film. It's
good
really,
movie.
Yeah, it's exciting. It shows some really bad things that are they, although it's, you know, crazy, it's grounded in a truth. So, you know, climate fiction has been around. I certainly did not make climate fiction. It found me. And I was like, okay, I think I'm going to write a book. I want to write a book. And I'm like, I don't know how to do that. So I kind of just started writing it with the intent to, oh, this is never going to be seen. This is just a hobby. And as I got further into it and the chapters started developing, and I realized that the world, unfortunately, for better or for worse, had all of the story ideas I needed to make a very realistic story. And I basically wanted to show people a world that was not a dystopian future. I'm really sick and tired of dystopian futures, because mm-hmm. we don't need any more of that. Some people would probably argue we're living in one right now, even though we're certainly not. There's still a lot of good things to count on, but no more of that. Let's write something that shows where we could take this in a good way. You know, working together to really mend some differences and work towards a common enemy, which is ourselves, and what we've done to our natural environments, and in turn to ourselves. So I eventually wound up with this manuscript that all the way back in 2015, that was, oh my God, it was 1,000 pages long in a Word document. It was unruly. I had no idea what to do with it. There were so many punctuation errors and grammatical mistakes, and I was like, this is crap. This is not going anywhere. But I did it, and I had my academic advisor at Florida Tech actually said, why don't you break it in half, make it two books? And I was like, no, I can't do that. And then I sat on it, and I was like, I'm gonna break it in half.
Yeah.
And I did, and that became the thing that is now self-published, which is The End of the Beginning.
It's the name of the book, right?
It's the name of the book, The End of the Beginning. Go ahead, John.
Well, so I think the first one was The End of the Beginning, and then there's a sequel, right, that's not yet out?
Correct. The sequel is called The End of the Beginning, Our Last Resolve. Okay. This is a quadrilogy that I'm trying to do. And then there are the two other books that I have self-published are short stories collections set within the same universe that kind of fill in the gaps for more content and some more smaller stories. But the book shows a future that's very close. Large time horizons. People are just like, 10 years from now, I don't know, whatever. So I said, the beginning of the part of the book is in, this kind of freaked me out. It's in 2020. Remember, I self-published this in 2017, and I have, the main character, William Emerson. He's in the U.S. Air Force. He's a pararescuer, and he is in the midst of the Second Korean War. And the United States and its allies are involved in a pretty bloody conflict where North Korea invaded South Korea. Something that could unfortunately maybe happen. Hopefully it won't. But William undergoes a tragedy early on in his life. His grandparents who raised him died in Hurricane Katrina. Again, an issue that many people are aware of and was very, very real. And this kind of scarred him and led him to where he is as a rescuer. And the conflict unfortunately goes nuclear, and the North unleashes a barrage of nuclear weapons on the South Koreans. And he is involved in a rescue attempt before the bomb goes off in the city of Incheon, South Korea, which is near Seoul. And And he witnesses firsthand the nuke go off as he's attempting a rescue. You know, pandemonium happens. People are trying to leave, get out. The fighter jets are just trying to get out of the area. Ships leave the harbor. They've only got minutes, and it kills all of his team members. And he basically, you know, just goes into isolation and is suicidal and thinks this is it. And then 7 years later, he gets approached from an organization under the United Nations that I called the United Nations International Rescue Organization, that has formed as a result of the Korean War. And ironically, I had those bombs going off on August 22nd, 2020.
We survived.
And yeah, that was a few days ago. And it hit me for a sec on that day. I hadn't even remembered. And I did. And I was like, oh my God, today is a day I had that happen. And how weird is it that we are in a moment that is changing our history right now? And I can only hope.
2020 has been rough for like completely different reasons.
Right. Interesting. Right.
But maybe as monumental. I don't know.
Yeah. But yeah, I basically wanted this event that shocked the world so much that it could no longer put its head in the sand and say, oh, nothing's wrong. We don't have to worry about this. And I had the book explain that the reason the North Koreans started this fictional war was because of a climate change induced drought. Mm-hmm. It led them to extreme resource deprivation. And they had no choice but to act out and try and invade for more resources, more territory. And of course it got bloody. And
but it's a very plausible scenario.
Right. So I have the world recognize this and say, you know, in the book I have 7 million casualties. And, you know, this just, as I'm sure it would, it just freaks everybody out. In the age of social media, I'm sure the videos that would come from an event like that would just be horrific. And people are like, we got to change. This is crazy. So they form UNIRO. And it's an organization dedicated to humanitarian aid, rescue, and climate change mitigation and adaptation. That implements large-scale geoengineering projects. This is where it gets a little fantastical. But again, I only found stuff that has actually been proposed. One straight off the bat is the organization dams the Bering Sea, the Bering Strait between Alaska and Russia, to keep to build up fresh water in the north of the dam from the Yukon River. That's probably very wrong. I don't remember offhand, but there's a major river that flows out into the Bering Sea there. And the theory is, and it's an actual theory put forth, is more fresh water, quicker freezing of the surface water. Salt water doesn't freeze as fast. So crazy things like that the organization can do. And I'm able to dabble climate change statistics in there with people maybe not even realizing it and saying, oh, this is cool. You know, I'd want to be a part of an organization like this, help people. You know, they got stylish uniforms. They just look good. Cool technology. And it's set in the year 2027. So not crazy far away. The book also touches on something which, funny enough, I saw an Economist article about this a few days ago of eco-terrorism. Mm-hmm. And, you know, with this type of inaction we're seeing from global governments, from our own government, will you see the rise of groups that kind of just take matters into their own hands and do things just to do it because we have no other choice? And we've the voting, the petitions, that hasn't worked. So what's the next logical step? And unfortunately, in the book, it's extremism. So that becomes the antagonist group to UNIRO, the protagonist group in the book, and they dish it out for control of, you know, do we go with UNIRO, who's run by the governments of old, or do we go with the groups called Terra Nova? Do we go with Terra Nova and build a whole new world with fire and brimstone and hopefully come out better on the other side? It's kind of this big, turns into this big philosophical debate, this techno thriller. I hope I made something really good. It's about, John, I think it was 500 something pages and fully finished and published. I know your listeners can't see it, but that's the cover.
I just want to say, like, my fingers hurt. I was flipping through those pages so fast. It was such a page turner. I actually remember I was like surprised, only because it was your first book. I was like, all right, we'll see how it is. And it was really good. So I
know
it
was
published, 3 years ago, which seems like a
eternity.
It seems like a long time ago. I was just, my mind flashed. I was in grad school like two apartments ago. I was reading it, but it's a really good read. But I think most important, it did do like what you said, Zach, where it put forth a scenario that's not this dystopian future, and it's not so far in the future where it's just like unbelievable, not relevant. So
yeah,
that's what I liked about it. But also, just saying as a reader, the characters in the book were phenomenal. just from a purely writing perspective, it was a fun read.
Thank you. Most, funny insider thing is for anybody that, grew up around me, was in college with me, they'll probably see their name mixed and matched with another person's last name or first name in the book as the characters. And I took a lot of influence from people, from normal, everyday, crazy conversations that we would have together at Panther Dining Hall would have became actual conversations in this book. That because the truth is stranger than fiction. And like I said, there is no shortage of content from every single day nowadays to put into literature. There's people. Simba Mamambri. I don't know if you remember him from college, but
shout out to Simba.
He is in this book, and I think he sounds like he did in real life, or like he does.
That was my favorite one, where it's like, I know I could tell you based some characters off of some people in your life, but Simba, it wasn't even based, like it was just him.
Yeah. It was.
Awesome.
So yeah, it's fun. It's writing's tough. It takes forever. That's why I probably turned to the short stories books. I got two of those out in 2 years, because they're really fun to write, and they can narrow down on topics very quickly. I'm trying to think of some. For example, in the first short stories volume I did online, I saw this instance of a landfill that it looked like it really didn't have any safety regulations. It's kind of one of those landfills that just popped up out of necessity adjacent to a slum area in Africa, and it collapsed, and a landslide of garbage literally destroyed and buried people in the slum adjacent to it.
That's no good.
And I think to myself, are you kidding me? Is that where we're at right now, where we have that much waste that people are now dying in our own waste? They literally get buried alive. This is terrible. So I wrote a quick short story about it, where Unero responds to an unregulated landfill fire and subsequent collapse. And just to quickly highlight the issue of, like, this is something that really happens. And, hopefully someone reads that and they say, no way, come on, this is not a landfill, landfill landslide. That doesn't happen. And then they'd be like, maybe I looked that up, and like, oh my God, it did. I got to put my waste down. So that type of stuff to inspire people to be like, this is a real issue. Maybe I need to learn more about it and do something about it.
Man, now I'm like self-conscious of like how much trash I use.
Right.
Yeah. I think it's time, James, I count three more questions that I want to get to, because this interview has been like so fruitful.
He has a few things that if this first part really went a
little bit quick. I got time. Don't worry.
Let's, one thing that we want to touch on for just about everyone is, can you just give us, and you already did a little bit, like, how did you get to where you are? And let's just say there's somebody watching who's like, oh, I want to do what Zach does. You know, what path did you take to get to your current position and your current role?
Yeah, how did you decide on your major, your college, and getting a job as well?
Like, all the way back.
Sure. All the way back. Okay. I applied to 3 schools in Florida. I never wanted to leave Florida.
You're a local, born and
raised.
Right?
Yes, born and raised.
Yeah.
I applied to FSU, Florida State University, Florida Atlantic University, FAU, and Florida Tech. Mm-hmm. I wanted to go to a place that offered collegiate tennis, which was probably a long shot to get to a D1 school, and a place that also had meteorology. I didn't want to be a number at a university, and I wanted like a nice education where people could know me and I could, walk across campus and not feel like I'm in a city. FSU declined me. So I was like, oh, that takes care of that. And then FAU, I got into FAU, but I was just kind of like, Florida Tech's a little bit far away from home. It's about 2 hours, not too far. FAU at the time for me was 30 minutes away. They have meteorology. It's a small school. I got on the tennis team immediately, which was great. I'm like, all right, I'm going here. Let's do it. And then 2.5 years in, I was not enjoying meteorology the way I wanted to. I have always struggled with math and physics. for anybody listening that feels like they have a hard time with math and calculus and all that stuff, you are not alone. I failed multiple times. And
meteorology is surprisingly heavy on the math and physics.
Extremely. I was like, this just is not turning in. This is not fun for me. It's really putting me off. And I struggled, honestly. And Florida Tech fortunately took the sustainability minor and got a major with it. And I signed up. I was like, you know what? I love the environment. I think wind turbines are really cool. I want to help with that. And in all seriousness, the job market was much better. And that really turned out to be true because you see, right.
You found that to be true,
yeah.
Which is maybe. So that leads me to ask, and this is kind of another side tangent. So I'm assuming if you were able to find, you know, a job that was basically just open when you applied in the city of Cape Canaveral, I would imagine a lot of cities all throughout the country, like you said earlier, yes, were doing the same thing. So that's cool that you found a place. that's a sneaky, really good job market that you found.
It seems to be pretty up and coming.
Yeah. Yes.
There is no, I don't think there's any shortage now for private or public positions of people looking for, and we take many names. In this county alone, there is someone of my equivalent position with the name sustainability planner, environmental programs coordinator, sustainability program manager, really all the same thing. Some cities have resilience planner only, like Miami has a position like that, or Miami-Dade County. I can't remember which two, but one of the Miamis. It's very up and coming. Everybody is looking to this as the thing that will be able to get them through what we have to get through. And also really, really, they want to save money. You know, people don't come at this usually from the perspective of, I want to save the world. I want to save money. I want to be able to make money off of what I do. And that usually is the quickest way to people's hearts still. So, you know, they see these efficiency gains that come up with these projects, even though sometimes they don't have the immediate cost returns. You know, some sustainability projects take a few years to recoup, but once they do, it's smooth sailing from there. So the job market only continues to grow, I think. But
that's not one of those things that's like plastered all over the news is, oh yeah, like get a degree in sustainability. But I hope people are listening and like heed what you're saying. It's exciting to hear that there's a big need for it.
Yeah. And I was, meteorology at the time seemed to be stagnating in terms of how many jobs were available. I have no idea where it's at right now. Like I said, I still love meteorology. I really do. I think it's so cool, but it just really wasn't working for me. And the thing that really helped me too, that I would also encourage listeners, I got an internship, and this internship probably did more for me than most other things that I did. Besides my own degree, getting this internship was extremely beneficial and made a lot of inroads for me. And that was an internship with the city of Satellite Beach, which is it's two cities down from Cape Canaveral, same Barrier Island. Incorporated in 1957, 58, one of those 2 years. They wanted a sustainability action plan, much like what I'm writing for Cape Canaveral. But you know, these plans can be expensive. You know, we're talking plans that could cost like $200,000 up to $500,000 to write from a professional consultant firm. And you know, small town, 10,000 again. They don't have that kind of money for that. So they outsourced it to Florida Tech. And I was chosen to write this plan because I had just switched majors into this, to sustainability. And my advisor, Dr. Ken Lindemann, great guy, tons of experience, worked for the United Nations, went all over South America, Caribbean, doing environmental work. He was like, well, Zach, you're going to get paid for this and you're going to write the entire future of the city. And I'm like, I failed the calculus. I don't know if I could do that. But I did, and it was a one-year project, and the city adopted it, and they kept me on as an intern, and they said, okay, we're going to hire someone full-time, and they're going to implement this plan, and you're going to help them. Good luck. And we did, and by the time I left, the city got the first solar array on its city hall of any city in Brevard County, 80-kilowatt system, pretty good.
Nice.
Got its first electrified vehicle in the fleet, Chevy Volt, as an admin vehicle. Got a dual charging station outside City Hall. We started a lot of programs really quickly once it was put in place, which was amazing to see how quickly things can change once people have a roadmap. But that allowed me to visit places, to get experience, and in that position, I visited the city of Cape Canaveral to see their stuff, what they got going on. And they had representatives visit us to see our new solar array. So those people remembered me and they contacted me when they knew my time was up for school. And they said, "Hey, we're going to have a full-time position. Do you want to take it?" And I was like, "Yeah, let's do it."
That's
and
pretty cool.
It really helped to have that internship. So
they contacted you, and then
they did.
And that's the position that you currently have, right?
It is.
Wow, that is so awesome.
Yeah, I also honestly, Res Life helped a lot too, because through that, not only did I get the presentation experience, the leadership experience, program planning experience, but through the our sustainability committee that we had internally within the organization, that allowed for a lot of real world projects to get started too, like the community garden that we built. At the time, 2017, Zach was like, "This is the greatest thing ever. This is the biggest thing we'll ever do." So I just
want to take a second to pause for people who don't know. I'm sure a lot of the early listeners will be, people who know me and you and James. But when you say Res Life, so that is Florida Tech Residence Life. So, these are the guys who patrol and monitor and take care of and facilitate activities in all the residence halls at our college, Florida Tech. And the only reason I point that out is because similar to you, I was an RA, a resident assistant, and it was just one of the most wonderful experiences of my whole life. Shout out to Res Life. I know there's probably going to be some people listening who are like nodding their heads right now. But it was the team that we had assembled there was so outstanding. And that was kind of one of the things that showed me like what it's like to be in a team that's just totally lockstep with each other.
Right.
All the way up to the leadership, Greg Connell. I hope you're listening too. But I know I remember when I came back to visit Florida Tech for the first time in a long time, which was last year. I'd been gone for like 5 years, but you were still there. Maybe it was 2 years ago. But anyway, I had never heard of this community garden idea. And then all of a sudden, Zach, you and I were like riding around in a golf cart and you're like, by the way, the community gardens. And I was like, what is this? Like, this is such a great idea facilitated by, because Res Life had a big hand in it, right? But you also had your own organizations.
The Res Life Sustainability Committee got it off the ground, right, and then it transferred to its own club. But that was great. Like you said, the team that we established for that committee was unbelievable, and really great leadership from for that one. That was Jacqueline Hetherington. She formed that committee and really got that off the ground. And I don't know where I'd be without that committee either, because so many people on that had good ideas. And if they're listening, Peter Zappala, Alexis Miller, Joe Torkeman was there for a bit, and probably 12 others at the time, that to get this thing off the ground. It was a huge student project. I think it was billed as the largest student-led project in at least a decade. I think before that it was that bridge that crosses between the quad and the sub.
That's right.
I think that was like from 08 or something like that. That was a student project, but it was really cool. And to, again, get this real world experience while still in school, plus having an internship, was just extremely helpful to get that experience off the ground. Cause I feel like a lot of people, they look for that, experience to help more so than grades. Cause I was freaking out about, oh my God, I have Fs. What is this? I can't graduate with Fs. Nobody's going to ever want me ever. And that's just not the case.
All right. I just want to get on a soapbox again, because this is what you're saying just resonates to me. Like, one thing I would say to anyone, and I'm sure a lot of our listeners are going to be out of college, but maybe not. Like, activities outside the classroom,
huge.
Were, I would argue, just as important as the ones in the classroom.
They're, they're going to help you more later on in life.
Yeah,
they really are. Yeah, like especially if you have like really distinct different things on there. That and I'm not talking about just for like a resume, like for your own development. Was so important. Like James and I was the president of Students for the Exploration and Development of Space. And James was the president of the Society of Physics Students. And we were basically sister organizations that met together. And like, that was when we learned that we work well together and can like run things and organize people. Yeah. Do that. Everyone who's listening, do that. get involved, work with people.
Yeah. Work with people, have ideas, build things, do stuff.
Yes. Yeah.
It'll teach you lots.
Yeah.
All right. Zach. Okay. Next question. And, you know, we're rolling through the questions. This is, again, you've already answered a lot of this, but if you could just have one answer to each of these. So given your position and kind of like what you know about the world and climate and sustainability and resiliency, what are you most hopeful about in the future in this climate? And then similarly, what are your biggest concerns and fears? And I'm not talking about just like you. I mean, like for as the city and as a nation and as a planet, you know, what are your thoughts on that?
Sure. All right. Let's do hope second. We'll end on hope.
Okay. Start with concern.
Concern. I get really worried about, obviously there's climate change and what we've done to the planet and will continue to do, no doubt, and how that will affect us as a society and not just America, but the world. We're so interconnected. Things that happen elsewhere will certainly affect us here. I think sometimes people forget that. And I'm really, you know, you've seen the rise of, unfortunately, disinformation. I've heard post-truth society. That's a little scary, you know, where you can have these uncontrolled areas of misinformation through social media and things like that. And then people in power that feed these myths and this disinformation, you know, is very dangerous. And we've kind of, without getting too political, we've kind of lost 4 years of action in this country. And I know we've had an entire world outside of us that can also take action. But you know, when you see a player like us go down in that commitment, it pulls others down too. I think the team elements, sounds kind of corny, but you know, we're a team and we're totally not holding up our end of the bargain here. And it's showing. Others have risen to the challenge and are excelling really well. But I do worry that, you know, we're forming into this hyper polarized society that's just, I don't know how that really gets undone right now. And the action or the non-action that's leading to is really scary. We have no more time to waste. And 2020 should be a wake up year for sure. Like in my book, 2020 was a wake up year. I really didn't think it would, we'd be so parallel in reality, which is really crazy. But, you know, this is it. The 2020s are really, we got to get our act together here or else we're going to be playing catch up for forever. So I do worry about a lack of inaction fed from political circumstances that you just, I don't know how to break right now, except with just more action from where you can get it, like at city level, state level, other countries, private organizations. So, yeah. And in hope, there's a lot of hope. There's a lot of hope. It's not over. I guess that's it. I see a ton of action coming from individuals, from cities, from states, from the more local level players that are really rising to the occasion and making enormous strides in holding up the movement to a more sustainable future. Private industry doing ton of cool stuff. I mean, look at SpaceX and what they've done and how quickly they've done it for the aerospace industry. and that's being applied to other sectors. You know, Tesla has just completely disrupted the automotive industry, whether the automotive industry knows it or not, they have. They will find out soon enough. That's a really good cause for hope, and stuff like that inspires people. You know, like I want to see a Starship that's the size of the Chrysler Building lifting off from a pad and just blow my windows out watching it 3 miles away. That's sick. I want to see a Tesla speed past a Mustang with those really loud mufflers, who thinks they're just, you know, hot stuff, and just silently blows past them with, you know, instant torque. And people see that and they're like, yeah, I want that. That's better. So, there's a lot of hope in terms of the private innovation and local level government that is really filling the gap. And it's so exciting to see. For listeners, the cities of Orlando, excellent, excellent example of what a municipality can do with the right leadership, massive strides in sustainability within really only a decade of work, which is, trust me, is something to say for a government. That's unbelievable change. Like they're well on their way to 100% renewable energy within their municipality. And there's millions of people in the Orlando area, New York City, Los Angeles, all of them are leading the way, and our international partners. So there's hope, because people will always see the problem and they will always fight for that. So I think we're going to get there. It might be slower than I hope, but I'd want, but we're going to get there. I know we're going to get there.
When you were talking about your concerns, I had that thought of, you know, the country's not taking action, but your little city is doing what you can.
Right. And if enough do it,
that's important.
Yeah. If enough do it, you know, we could do it. I firmly believe it might sound bad, but we don't need the federal government right now. It's best they actually stay out of the way. So we'll do it ourselves, because we have to, and we see the issues firsthand. We're on the front lines. So
yeah, it affects you.
We'll get it.
What advice would you give to a young person who's interested in doing what you do?
I would tell them, definitely don't lose hope. I know there could be people that definitely say, don't do that. It's not even real. Why are you worrying about that? Like, this is the position to go into right now. It can open up so many doors, and you can affect a lot of people's lives with a position like this. I have to be reminded of it sometimes. We're human. We get down sometimes, but we're making a difference. And I would urge that they get involved as quickly as possible, even if it's in a volunteer position at a nonprofit or some NGO. Like, just start doing stuff. You know, even in Brevard County, the Brevard Zoo, it's so involved with local stuff. Go volunteer for, put some oyster beds in a river body to clean the water, get some reef or shoreline protection, you know, and then make those contacts. A lot of people that show up there probably have been doing this for a long time, and they could get you some insights into where to go. Get a local government internship. Be on a board. If you can, I interned with Satellite Beach. I helped facilitate the Satellite Beach Sustainability Board, which is a citizen board. Incredible experience. People showed up from everywhere with a lot of experience. Companies would come in to do demonstrations of products for the board, and you meet people and you get connected really quickly. So get involved as early as you can, and don't be afraid to sit in those meetings and ask questions, and don't be afraid to talk after. Stop them at the door.
I just want to point out, like what you said, like get involved with your city or community, like get on a board. Like that goes for everyone. Like yeah. The older I've gotten, the more I've realized that like participating in your local government is like easier than you might think.
Yes.
And like go find a place where you can participate like that. Not just for someone who's looking into like doing this as a career, but like just as a member of your community, go do it and participate. So I totally agree with that one.
Yeah.
All right.
John, do you want to go over the most important question on here?
Oh, yeah. I think I know what these are. These are good.
Well, Zach, I'm about to ask you the most, forget about all this other stuff about climate action and like saving Florida from sea level rise and everything. Let me ask you the most important question.
Zach, what is your favorite pizza topping?
Okay. Okay. Mushroom. Nope. Yes, mushrooms. I like mushrooms.
Really? Yeah. That's it?
Mushrooms are good.
Wow.
That's the most hesitation we've had on this so far.
It is. It's like you were about to say something crazy, but then just you went for mushrooms.
I like black olives a lot too.
Why mushrooms?
I just like their texture. I think they taste good. I think they go well with the other ingredients on the pizza. And trying to be more or eat less meat, and mushrooms are a good substitute for like the beefy products. Steak, mushroom steak, things like that. So I've always liked mushrooms. I'll eat them raw, I'll eat them cooked, fried, whatever. I like mushrooms.
You're actually blowing me away right now, because mushrooms, like, I don't disagree with this. Like, that's a great topping because they're kind of bigger and like fleshier, you know, there's substance there.
Right. They have the texture of meat. They're often in the culinary world, they have the texture of meat.
Right.
I might get a mushroom pizza next. And it's funny that we talk about this, that we have you on the show, Zach, because you're one person. I'm sure I've taken you to Bizarro's Pizza.
Yes.
Yeah. So the three people that are speaking right now, me, James, and Zach, we've gotten a lot of pizza together. Zach, I don't know if I've gotten as much with you, but
we definitely got pizza though. That's a good restaurant.
I said John and I get pizza there quite a bit.
I mean, it was all the time. So funny that we're all together again. We ought to go to Bizarro's one of these days. Shout out to Bizarro's. If by some miracle you guys are listening, please don't ever change your recipe. Keep doing it. Keep doing what you're doing. Zach, why don't we get to this question? We're kind of like long on time over here, but let's just say people want to follow you. How would people be able to follow you? Any just little plugins you'd be able to provide?
Yeah, I'm most active on LinkedIn, so you can just search my name. Sustainability Program Manager for the City of Cape Canaveral, Zachary Eichholz. I like LinkedIn a lot. There's usually a little bit more focused crowd on LinkedIn. So that's nice. And if anybody wants to see book information, they can go to the book's website, which, oh God, it has not been touched in probably 2 years. So it probably needs some maintenance. It's a good old Wix site, but it's called theendofthebeginning.info. And that has links to the books that I have so far published. That's what I got.
All right, check it out. Get ready for a huge new wave of visitors to the site.
I hope so. That'd be great. I get to collecting dust. I gotta wipe it off.
Awesome.
Well, thanks for talking with us today.
Is so cool. This is so cool. Keep this up. I love podcasts, and I think the world loves podcasts. Everybody, podcast is the thing.
Well, it's just funny because you were noting that like you were able to use writing as a means to reach out to people and communicate topics that are important to you. And that's really what this is. And I think we have the advantage of having a lot of friends and even extended network people who are on the front lines of these issues, like yourself.
Right.
So it's been an awesome time so far. So yeah, we intend to keep it going. This is never a joke. We always say we can't wait to have you back on whenever you're whenever you want to, whenever you're in charge of the next big thing. I don't know what it's going to be, director of some enormous thing, but I think you've been an incredible guest. Let me just take one other moment to just say to all the listeners out there, if you like what you're hearing, go ahead and subscribe. Hopefully by this point we've already launched. And also with every episode, you'll probably notice there's a little link where you can provide us some feedback for the episode. Just, basic questions,
A survey. Like, yeah.
A survey. Yeah. So, how are we doing? 0 stars, 5 stars, just be truthful. And that'll help us make every episode better. And similarly, you leave recommendations for things like, oh, I'd like to see this topic or this topic. So anyone who's listening, go ahead and do that.
And we all would just like to give a huge thank you to Zach for giving us your time.
Thanks, guys. This is great. Really, keep this up. This is so cool.
Awesome.
This is so cool.
Yep. Very good. Well, there you have it, everyone. Have a good night.